This is videotape number 12B, Hit Them Where It Hurts, Finding Holes in COTS Software.
Yeah. All right, well, I'll just disable this one for the sake of the instant. So, something I think I should mention before I start here is that while I am bashing Checkpoint all the time, I have to say that I have hardly ever experienced a company being more responsive to security issues. And they've been really nice about everything, and they even sent me the new service pack when I didn't have it. And while I'm doing all those jokes here, it's not really meant to, seriously decrement the image that Checkpoint has in the security community. So, don't take anything I say too seriously. All right. So I demonstrated stuff and we had our break. So I think I'll just continue. Well, sometimes vendors take their time with patching things and they have to do a lot of regression testing and all those things. And a scanf can easily take a month or two to fix. So sometimes you just don't want to be standing bent over. So you might just decide to fix stuff before the vendor does, just in order to be safe. I have to tell a little war story here. I used to do penetration testing in Asia, not the way you think, like network security penetration testing. And anyways, what I was doing there, basically we had large penetration tests on a rather large bank, and they had this really nice setup, like, they had a good firewall, only leaving ports 80 and 25 incoming open. Everything else was filtered. And beyond that firewall, they were running a Lotus SMTP server and Netscape Enterprise as their main web server. And they had guys from Sun come in to harden the network and so on. And all the connections on their internal network were running over SSL, so you couldn't sniff, or you couldn't sniff without man-in-the-middle attacks or whatever. So basically, the problem was that we got not really hired to get in there, but just to confirm they're safe. So we were the first ones to actually look at the applications. And well, eventually we got in through Lotus Domino SMTP and took control of that computer and then started collecting the POP passwords that would come into the Lotus Domino SMTP server. And after a day or two, we pretty much had a list of all POP passwords in that company. And you all know how users reuse their passwords all over the place. So they got owned pretty badly. And we sent this problem to Lotus, and they didn't really respond. And then they said, well, we'll have a fix in about a month or so. And then you had to explain management of that bank, hey, fellas, well, you're bent over there, and you can't really do anything about it. So, well, eventually they asked us if we can't do anything about it. And we offered them that I would patch the binary of Lotus Domino. That is something you should not do unless you get a signature that you are not liable for anything. So once you get that signature, you might just as well go ahead and do stuff the vendor takes a long time for. And it's usually quite amusing if you take into account that the vendor takes, well, several weeks of regression testing and, well, it takes about a month to fix a serious bug, apparently. And usually it's a matter of 15 minutes in the disassembler and a hex editor. So, well, anyways, the theory of patching. Usually if you, well, patch security vulnerabilities, you want to add secure code in place of the bad code. So you need room. And in all modern executable file formats, such as PE, COF, ELF, you have something called caves. Basically, the text and the data sections are aligned to certain values. Under Windows, it's usually 200 hex, if not page alignment, which is 4,096 bytes. So between the real end of a section and, well, the end which is declared in the file header, there's room for you to add code. And there have been quite a few viri to exploit this, most notably the CIH, which was the first big public cave-threatening virus. So basically, the place to add your code is caves. Because you can add code without messing around in the file header and adding sections and doing all the annoying stuff. So what you want to do is, well, you take the vulnerability, patch a jump right before that offending call or right before that offending code, jump into the cave where you have placed your good code, and then you jump back into the application to pass control right after the call where the vulnerability has happened. So I'll quickly, well, we'll patch two vulnerabilities in the CSM proxy, and then we'll move on to something more interesting. 1 second. Gotta sit down again and switch microphones. Yes? Because in order to completely disassemble, fix the assembly code and reassemble, you need to have a complete and good disassembly. And a complete and good disassembly of a large application is something that is very, very time consuming, because the disassembler is bound to screw up at some point. And you'll have undefined bytes, and you will perhaps not understand things correctly. And frequently you're breaking things this way. And why would you go through the process of generating a huge assembly language output? Remember, disassemblies are large. And a lot of assemblers choke when you feed them an assembly file which is larger than, say, 20 megabytes. So it's a lot easier to just patch right away using a hex editor. Okay. So first off, we're going to fix this stupid scanf here, which does not involve adding code to caves. Because it's pretty simple. Oops. So basically, what we're going to do with the scanf here is we're just going to add, well, the standard scanf size checking. We're going to replace the straight %s with a %99s or %127s, which is pretty straightforward. The hex editor I'm using is a Russian thing called Hiev. So the offending %s is at location 50D970. Okay, so we can see we have the %s, then a trailing null byte, and then the login. So we see that we don't really have room here to, well, add 127. So we have one null byte before we can use, and one null byte after. So if we replace this %s here with a %, I don't see my cursor anymore, does anybody? 25. Okay, here it is. All right. Okay, so we replace it with a %99s and update the file. We still have to manipulate the original push, which was pushing this, because we moved the string backwards one byte in the original file. So we go to location 43365C. Okay, here we are. We switch into debugging or disassembly mode. To enter the address again, 43365C. And here we are, here's the push. And we want to move it one byte backwards, so we replace this 50D970 with the 50D96F. Like this. We update the file.
You also have to make sure that this string isn't used anywhere else.
This is something that IDA tells us here. We only have one cross-reference to this, and that's in the split IMAP command. Of course, you have to pay attention to this, yes. Can have pretty nasty consequences if you don't. But, well, the other guy signed something that you are not responsible, so. Okay, we connect. One hundred plus eight is not 128. Okay, 110. Nobody ever said that counting was easy. On 20, why not 28? Nothing happens. We successfully patched this problem. Okay. Now, just a short note while I'm calling this software piece of crap. You see this? Perhaps it's a bit more obvious this way. Well, yeah, they're, right after the vulnerable scanf, they're using a straight string copy. So, in order to take control of EIP this time, we need to send 1024 bytes, I'm not good at math, so we're probably going to send somewhere around 1200 bytes. And we should get control of EIP again. I got this test.txt, which is full of A's. We're gonna send it. And here we go again. So now I think you understand why this is a piece of crap. It goes on like this. Basically, in order to identify about 10 distinct buffer overruns in this software, you'd have to invest about 15 minutes of work. So, all right, but the nice thing about this one is we can now properly patch something a bit more complex than a scanf format string. So, what we do want to do here is we want to place a jump pretty much right here. Jump to the cave, push a maximum length parameter, push the source buffer, push the destination buffer, and call an str end copy instead. We then have to clean up the stack and jump back right here.
Would you have enough caves to patch?
Yeah, the caves are usually quite large. And you mean whether there's enough room in the caves to patch all the vulnerabilities?
Yeah.
That's a good question. That's a very good question. I doubt it, seriously. Okay, got me there. See, those checkpoint people are pretty sharp guys. All right, okay. All right, it's already stopped. So we hex edit it again. Okay, and we go the beginning of the second section. And then we scroll upwards, and we see all this null padding, which is a cave. Okay. So I think, unfortunately, I don't have anything to write, so I need some pretty good memory right now. We're gonna patch our code at location F9590. Okay. So, whoops, switch to decode mode, we go to F9590, and there we add our code. First off, we want to push the value 3FF, which is 1023. Okay, next, we want to have a move ECX EBP plus 8. Then we push ECX. We want a load effective address EDX EBP minus 480. And now we've got to figure out where strncopy is at. Here it is, and it's at the location in the program of E4AE0. Okay, so we do a call E4AE0. Whoops, forgot to add the OX. E4AE0, was it that? Yeah, okay. and then we add ESP12. Because we have to clean up the stack again. Okay, now we need to jump back to this location here, which is at the physical location in the file of 33680. Okay, we got the code added in the cave. What we now want to add is the jump to our code. The jump to our code has to be added at location 43366D, and this is a virtual address. Ah! Nothing, everything's all right. Just screen for fun. Okay, here we have our code, and we want to go to location 433, what was it again? 43366D. Okay, here we are. I lost the display again.
Just one display.
Toshiba, piece of crap. Actually, I had a really nice Russian no-name notebook before, and it was really bulky and really heavy and really slow. But the nice thing about it, it didn't look as if anybody would want to steal it in the first place. And secondly, well, wait a second, I'll figure a way to fix this. No, I don't.
Must be the switch, because
must be this splitter. So, well, somebody told me he would be just one scream away. Should I scream? Actually, I don't think I will get this fixed. Okay, somebody's going to take care of it. So, anyways, I was telling you about the nice laptop I used to have. So, the nice laptop I used to have was really bulky, and I have to travel to my working place in a bus, which is full of drug addicts, because it's the main drug trafficking route in that city. And you have all those people sitting at the end of the bus, and they're like, telling me how many houses they could own if they wouldn't take so much coke or whatever. So, anyways, from time to time what happens is, well, I'm sitting in the bus typing, and with the old laptop I could sit there typing because it looked like you could hit somebody in the head with it if you tried to take it. And the new one actually looks expensive, and I have to figure some way to kind of make it more beautiful, less looking like a female handbag or whatever. No, the other laptop, you just have the impression of stability with it, because this one, you have the impression the screen is actually stabilizing the case, not the other way around. So, I fear I might have to continue with one screen. Blackhead will gladly pay you a massage afterwards. Okay. Hello? Okay. So, where was I? Oh, okay. We wanted to patch something in here, namely a jump into our cave. So, as I have a bad memory, the cave is located at F9590. So we had this jump. Whoops. Right, save it, and now we trace it in the hex editor once more to make sure we haven't done any stupid mistakes as usual. Okay, we're jumping to location 4F9590. This is here. We execute our code. We jump back to 433680, which is here, which is correct, or should be at least. So what we do now is we stop hex editor and we start the service. Those who can read are at a clear advantage here. Okay, and we pipe our file into it and nothing happens. So we successfully patched this as well. But it might be that we're running out of caves at some point, true. So, haha. Any improvements or anything we can say about the switch?
We're trying.
Okay. But see, it's on there, so.
Is there a signal going to the projector?
The signal is going to the switch at least.
Yeah, this one's supposed to be there.
No, no, both are supposed to be on.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is supposed to be there and there.
Oh, at the same time.
So it's the switch. Or the split cable. Well.
It's two.
I'm running out of stories to tell, sorry. So, all right, let's continue. I told you before that I would be going into the theory of runtime encryption. Runtime encryption is something bad shareware programmers use in order to prevent evil crackers from cracking their copy protection. And runtime encryption is something that, well, expensive CAD applications use and expensive server applications use because they're using a dongle for license management. So basically the way these runtime encryptors work is pretty similar to the way viruses work or viruses work. You have the original entry point, you add some descrambling code at the end of the executable, then you move the entry point to the end of the executable into the descrambler. And then you scramble the contents of the file. So when the file is executed, the descrambler runs first, descrambles the file, and then passes execution back to the original program. This is something that could be pretty useful to screw over all those forensic people who can't handle disassemblies. Well, just a hint. And ELF crypting under Linux is possible, so. Anyways, in order to deal with these things, you have to find the original entry point. Either by tracing through the descrambler, dealing with all the anti-debugging crap and all that, and as soon as the control is gotten or given back to the original program, at that point, while you repair the, well, I'm getting ahead of myself, so you just have to trace through until the control is getting passed back to the original program. Alternatively, you can create compiler signatures, because the programmer who is wrapping his program is using a standard compiler. You hook into one of the standard API calls that the compiler uses during startup, and then you know that you have reached the entry point. The advantage of this is you can just replace part, like you hook into kernel 32, so the program has no real way of knowing what's there, because you never know what's in kernel 32 anyways. Well, anyways, the advantage of this is that anti-debugging will not work. Afterwards, you have to repair all the damage the cryptor has done to the executable, which can be quite annoying, because some cryptors, well, like parse the code and swap out entire parts of the code into other areas of memory and do similarly annoying stuff. So you repair all the damage being done, you repair the dynamic link tables and so on, and then you dump the file to disk, and you should have an unpacked file which runs fine. This is incredibly time consuming if you do it manually, but there are tools and ways of doing this semi-automatically. Most notably, iStump, written by a crazy Bulgarian and an even crazier Hungarian. They have added code to the Windows 90X version of SoftICE, and they were really bored, and they decided they'd first want an automated unpacker and repairing plugin for SoftICE. And then they noticed that they're spending a lot of time in the kernel debugger, and listening to MP3s while you're in the kernel debugger doesn't work. So they added a kernel mode MP3 player to SoftICE. then they decided they were bored, so they took apart SoftICE screen, like the entire screen control thing, and added a Ring Zero Tetris. And at some point, they decided they're bored with Ring Zero and did something else. But it's a pretty impressive piece of software. It can be found at icedump.tsx.org, and it comes with about 400K of assembly language source if you feel like getting a really bad headache. Okay. There are other tools to do unpacking as well. There is something called procdump, which is pretty old by now, written by a very capable French guy, which did try to unpack from Ring 3. And then there is a lot of specially designed tools for one specific packer. Like there is a very common packer called ASPAC on ASPAC, not ASPAC. Anyways, ASPAC. ASPAC, which is a very widespread packer under the NT platform, and there are specialized tools which only work on one specific packer to unwrap that certain packer. So for ASPAC, there is KeySPR, and those can be found at all those copy protection related sites like protools.cjb.net and so on. Look around for them. They're out there. Just have to ask nicely. Okay.
Don't mind me.
I don't. Okay. I told you before that it might be useful not to spend too much time in the disassembler. So you want stuff to work automatically. So, I wrote a small IDC script which scans for suspicious printf calls automatically. Basically, it checks for a few criteria. Woohoo! Quit stealing the applause. Right. So it checks for various criteria. First of all, it checks whether the format string contains a %s. Secondly, it checks whether the string which is being expanded is non-static. Thirdly, it checks whether there is an argument deficiency. And if there is an argument deficiency, it checks whether the format string is dynamic or static. And, the demonstration script is called sprintf.idc. You can ask me to give it to you if you want to. If you've been to my training class, you got it anyways. And I think I'll post it to Black Hat's website at some point, real soon. So, it's actually a pretty lame piece of software. It's quickly hacked together and more buggy than anything else. All right, I gotta switch mics again. Okay, so here we are in CSM proxy. We go into the sprintf location, and then we load our script. And then we tell it to analyze sprintf. And we let it run. Shoop-de-doo. Okay, that's done. We hit control X to see all the sprintf calls. We have 628 calls to sprintf, and the script was nice enough to mark up all the dangerous ones. So the next step one would have to undertake, which is slightly more annoying, is you have to look at those format strings and see whether you can pass any user supplied data into this. So this is one of the larger format strings, contains quite a few %s, and you have to start doing this buffer size arithmetics again. So basically you check out what the size of every buffer expanded in the %s is, and then you add the size of the format string, and when you have added all that together, and it exceeds the size of the format string, you know that this is potentially dangerous. So actually this can be done automatically. Just haven't had time to write anything yet, so sorry. All right, this one was the automated scanning for sprintf problems. I think I'll switch back to the slides. Hello? Okay, I told you before that I'm not going to analyze strn copies, and we're going to move on to scanning for format string vulnerabilities. So as we will frequently encounter wrappers around stuff like vsprintf, vsmprintf, and so on, We want the format string script to be as flexible as possible. So we only want to feed it the absolutely necessary data, which is, in this case, the address of the function we're analyzing, the amount of stack correction it should have, and which number, like the argument number where the format string is located at, so the script can check whether, well, the format string is dynamic or not. So what we'll look at is checkpoint firewall 1. And I will just quickly load it up in the disassembler. It'll take some time because it's quite large. Actually, the reason why I got this Toshiba piece of crap is that after my last presentation in Las Vegas, people were complaining to me that my laptop is so slow. And, well, it took like 5 minutes to load a larger database. And as the old laptop had about 32 megabytes of RAM, and the databases are easily like 80 megabytes big, you can imagine that this was getting a bit boring. If you want to make hardware donations, I'm open. You know that you learn to draw really well if you're bored in front of your computer and you have a piece of paper? You get lots of practice, really. Yeah, sure. Yeah. So the question was, how do I know that I'm not overwriting important data when I add my own code to the cave? Well, the reason is there is no important data in the cave. Because the caves are there which are compiler generated. And if the program uses like a bunch of nulls or a bunch of zeros somewhere, it will not be behind the original section. It will be somewhere inside the section. With the hex editor, basically. It's in the file header. The file header under Windows specifies both the physical size and the virtual size, although some compilers screw up on that. So usually you take the, well, there's the file alignment value, and you take that file alignment value and check it against the physical size, and then you know where the physical size, like the physical section ends. And if you go behind that, well, you are where no compiler has ever gone before. Sorry?
Do you need to change the header?
No, you don't. No need to do that. Just if you append another section or if you want to close the caves. Actually, there used to be a very nice trick against cave drilling viree. You would just change the header values in the executable to make the virus think there's no cave left. But, well, don't try to outsmart the virus writers. They'll come out to get you. All right, here we are. This is a disassembly of Firewall 1, so Checkpoint Firewall 1, version 4.1, Service Pack 2. Now, I can assure you lots of the bugs you can find here are still present in Service Pack 4, but there has been a hotfix on Monday, which fixes the RDP problem. And according to the people from Checkpoint, which I've met here, the bug that I'm going to find here is fixed with that one as well. Told them about 3 weeks ago, and it made it in. Well, I didn't see any mentioning of Black Hat yet, but we'll see about that. It's not like I'm out for the spotlight anyway, so. All right, so we can see that we got 32 calls to vsnprintf. So we got 32 wrappers to vsnprintf, which are potentially dangerous performance string bugs here. We go to the first one and start our boring work again. Go to the very top of the function. We can see that we have three arguments. And as it's a function which uses varargs, a variable number of arguments, we can be pretty sure that the correct stack correction is therefore 12 bytes. And the format string will be the second last argument, usually. Doesn't have to be, but in this case it is. And if you get really strange results from the script, you might check whether it's actually the case, but for now we'll just assume it. So We load the format string script. We tell it where we're at. We tell it the minimum stack correction. And the format string is argument 2. It parses through here, and we can see no format string bug has been found. So we move on to the next wrapper. Whoops, we can see. Oh, I already ran the script against this one, sorry. So, we'll just erase the comments and then run the script again. Okay, so right now the script is still buggy to a certain extent because it thinks that the only valid format string must have 2 bytes, percent and something. So if somebody's doing something like sprintf space or printf space, the format string script will think this is dangerous because it cannot identify the single space as a valid string. But that doesn't really matter. You can live with about 1 false positive in 100. So we open this, we tell it where we are at. Minimum stack correction is 12, argument is 2. It's finished. It thinks it has found 2. This one, oops, I'll just close this window here. This one is one of the famous cases where we have a 1-byte format string, so this is not interesting. And this one is one of the cases where IDA screwed up the disassembly, so this is not interesting either. So we are back here. Moving on, another VSN printf. 29 to go. Okay, so we run the format string script. In this case, we have a stack correction of 16. Run through. I've identified one down here. Now remember, the third argument is the format string. So it's passing, it's passing EDI into the function as a format string. And here you have a sprintf storing %s failed, where they create this error message and then pass it on into this function. So whenever an attacker can put data into this %s, he has a potential, or he can execute arbitrary code as he can write to arbitrary addresses in memory. So this is one. We're not going to go deeper into that. That was the only one the script identified here. Moving on. The fourth sprintf, 28 to go. Run the script. I know reverse engineering is not particularly exciting. Okay, stack correction 12, argument 2. Having it run. Check. Okay, here we go. Format string problem here. Second argument is the format string, EBX here. So we see where EBX is loaded. Okay, now here you have to know something about Firewall 1. It stores a lot of strings in one large hash table. And basically when it communicates with the management client, it seems that all the data being sent by the management client is first stored in this large hash table and then retrieved later on. So this function here retrieves data from this hash table. And the data being collected from this hash table has been filed under log failed. So it retrieves that string and goes back and feeds it into this function, and this is a format string bug. And we're not going to go deeper into that either. And here we have EDI being loaded again, or being used as format string again. And EDI has been loaded up here with the hash table lookup with the string SPI. We're not going to go into that either. There's still a few to go before we reach the interesting stuff. Well, slightly interesting. EDI being loaded with a hash table string of user. So, I don't know if somebody can put something in there. You have to be authenticated as an admin anyways, because this is happening in the admin parsing module, or administrative client parsing module. EDI, we go upwards. String template. So if somebody can file something on the template, he has probably gained something. Group. Extended user group. all of these should be investigated further, whether you can do anything with them. So ref name, we're not going into that. Sec and set. Subject. Subject is fun because when the client or the GUI client or administrative client is communicating with the firewall, subject is, well, the name under which the commands which are sent are stored. So the first command the client sends to the server is a log database command. Of course, after it has been authenticated and an encryption communication channel has been set up. So basically what we see here is that if an unknown command is being sent, that unknown command is being passed on as a format string into the logging function. So by replacing the string log database in the GUI client, we can write to arbitrary addresses in memory. So we'll just do that. Okay, here's the log database command. And in order to make the firewall crash, we replace it with a %n. So, okay. Now we run the firewall policy editor. Okay. So in order to have everything look a bit more nicely and be a bit more visual, we're going to set a breakpoint inside firewall 1. Oh, firewall 1 isn't started yet. Takes a bit of time. Okay, so we're going to set a breakpoint. Oops, sorry. At location 494400, which is the hash table lookup. And then we'll see what happens here. Okay, here we are. Okay, we're going to edit our breakpoint a bit. That's ESP plus 8, I think. So if I haven't made a stupid mistake, this should display us both the string being requested by the hash lookup and the string being returned by the hash lookup. Yes. So at the very bottom, you can see which strings are being taken from the hash table and which are returned. So our subject is not coming up yet. It will be in a minute. Oh, there was the first reference to our subject. Here's the second one. And this is not where we're supposed to be yet. Here we go. You see the %n or %n database. And here it gets passed into the logging function. Not yet. Whoops. Oh, here we are. Here it gets passed into the logging function, finally. The push 69 is there. And now, basically, I'll just let the program run and hope that soft ice will catch the fault. Here we go. We recognize this from early on in the chapter of how to exploit format string bugs. So here again, we have well, the value in ECX being moved to the address in EAX, and this is a format string bug in Firewall 1, which you can trigger as soon as you're authenticated to read logs on the firewall, and which means that as soon as you can read logs on the firewall, you can execute arbitrary code on the firewall. And it has, according to Checkpoint, it has been fixed on Monday, or the fix is out since Monday. So much for automated finding of format string bugs. I hope you enjoyed it. And we move on to more interesting things now. Or depends on who you are, whether they're interesting or not. So if you're somebody using Checkpoint Firewall for anything critical, keep in mind that, I haven't found anything more serious. And for this one, you have to be authenticated as, well, at least a valid admin who is allowed to read logs. So this is not like the ultimate catastrophe waiting to happen. Just a small one. All right. Originally, I had not prepared for Checkpoint fixing this bug in time. Well, this has nothing to do with Checkpoint. It's just that I had thought that perhaps they might not be able to get it fixed until today. So I didn't want to speak about a product which is out there and protecting critical things and demonstrating bugs in it. So I had originally intended to do a hypothetical example on a program called PackJoint BioFire 1. We've all gotten around this, so let's move on. Okay, so all the juicy vulnerability crap is over right now, so if you're only interested in zero day, you can go. Other than that, I'll go into a bit of the esoteric reverse engineering things right now. Reasons why we need to reconstruct structures. Structures are important as they are being widely used, and as I mentioned before, we do have to do a lot of buffer size arithmetics. And without knowing the sizes of the buffers, we're screwed. And during the compilation process, all information about buffer sizes is pretty much gone. Excuse me for a second. So if we're going to estimate the sizes of any buffers, we have to reconstruct structures. And, well, this takes forever and a day if done manually. Does anybody have the time and can tell me how much time I got left so that I can see whether I can show you how it takes forever and a day? 20 minutes left? Oh, well then, we got time. All right. All right. This is a program called iMail. It's a widespread SMTP server. This is a program called iMail. It's a widely used SMTP server. Half of Asia seems to be running on these things. And the code quality is not very good, but it's not exceptionally bad either. Usually it takes you more than an hour to find a bug. So what we can see here is that it is referencing buffers in structures quite a lot. For example here, arg4 is obviously a pointer to a structure, and bo8 is the offset in that structure. So if we were going to reconstruct the structure manually, we would have to go to the IDA structures window, create a structure, create a member, create another member at the right offset, create another byte, go in here, add the first member. Here's the second one, which is at address 1308 hex. So we calculate 1308 minus BO8, which is 800. So, we add this and another field, and now we can add a member here. And please repeat this for every structure member. And this takes forever and a day. So, First off, the first attempt at doing this was a really messy and ugly and annoying, and did I mention ugly, IDC script, which will basically take a stack variable in a given function and trace all access to it. I will be making that one public on the web, Black Hat website as well sometime, or like soon. It's pretty much half a year old now, so. It's called basobjrec.idc. And we trace the function main handler, and the pointer to our structure is arg4, and we have a run through there and call this structure iml1. So it traces through all of it. Now we hit shift F9, and it has created this nice large structure up here, which we can now collapse, like we have to collapse all the members. But we can get a pretty nice estimate of the individual buffer sizes. Of course, this is far from perfect because we're only tracing one function. Should script this collapsing as well. Okay, so here we have a pretty decent estimate of how the structure looks like. So that saved us a lot of work. Unfortunately, this structure only traces one function. And as you can imagine, the more functions you trace which operate on the same structure, the more accurate your representation of that structure will be. So the first thing you would want would be recursion, to recurse into all the subfunctions which get past this pointer as well. I wrote a small plugin for that, a real IDA plugin, because the IDC language would crash on me after about 10 or 15 layers of recursion. So the plugin will be made, well, like, should be public soon as well, as everything. And, whoops, oh, it's not loaded. I have to load a legacy version of IDA. I haven't compiled it yet for the new version. Sorry. Okay, here we go. We feed the name of the function we're dealing with. And name it structure black hat or whatever. And this plugin actually goes into all the subfunctions. And the reconstruction we're getting is a lot more accurate than the one we had before. So this is probably pretty close to the original structure, actually. Of course, you'll have a few double words recognized as uneven numbers, but all in all, you should be pretty much set. Okay. So this is how the reconstructed structure looks, and now we can do pretty good buffer size arithmetics on these things and, well, use this. So much for structure reconstruction. Yes?
I assume that would get really confused if you had a lot of unions or offsets into strings within structures.
If you reference into strings within structures, it will get confused, but it will not get confused by unions, as it does not even try to parse unions, it just estimates buffer sizes. So you will not notice when you're using a lot of unions, so your structure you get will not be similar to the structure the programmer uses, but the buffer sizes will be reconstructed. And the buffer sizes is what we're going for. I'm not going to write a C++ decompiler. So kind of depends on what you're doing. You're right that unions are a bitch to reconstruct. Well, I'm not going to switch microphones now because I think I have to sit down pretty soon. Okay, I did this. Okay, concerning auditing object-oriented code, the main reason why nobody has really looked at IIS, for example, from a reverse engineering perspective is that it's pretty much all object-oriented or a lot of C++ code. And everybody who has tried to, well, reverse engineer C++ code without knowing the class data layouts gets really bad headaches. Joey, for example, told me he had tried to look at IIS for 2 days and then he had given up because the code is so freaking ugly. It's not that the C++ code is so ugly, but the disassembly of the C++ code is so ugly. I can't tell whether the original C++ code is so ugly, but 30% of it is dead. So, the next step after I finished the structure reconstruction was logically object and class reconstruction. Because as I said before, the more functions we have which operate on the same structure, the better for us because we get a more accurate representation. So last week I actually finished another plugin for IDA which does vtable parsing. You'd give it a vtable, like the place where an object stores all its virtual methods, and it parses through there and calls, well, the structure reconstruction once for every function in the vtable. What I still need to implement in that plugin is real this call recursion, because the this call calling specification will not pass the this pointer in as a stack argument, but in a register. And that can be quite annoying to code properly if you want to do full recursion there. So I'll have to do that, I don't know, next week. So I have a short demonstration on how this plugin works. For this purpose, I load up the IIS core web server, like the one that has never had any public bugs yet. It's true, the core web server has not had any, sorry, yeah, I will. The core web server has not had any buffer overruns yet, was all in extensions. So here we have a vtable for the WAM request class, and I am in the wrong version of IDA because I need the new one. Crap. Okay, here we go. We have this nice vtable here, and this pointer is being passed as a stack variable in this case. So I will just run the new plugin. It asks me whether I want to do a vtable parsing because it hasn't found any code at the current address, and I say yes, please. I tell it arc 0 is the thing to trace, and we name the structure. Oh, wait. WAM request. And then we say no recursion because the recursion is not done. And we let it run for a while. And we go into IDA. Oh, this is wrong. Here we are. This is WAM request. For some reason, yeah, here we go. So you can collapse this. The plugin has screwed up at the very end of the structure because it has apparently added the value of -1 to it. So it is a bit larger than even Microsoft would create structures. But we can fix that manually quite easily. But as you see, we get a pretty good estimation of how things look like. At this point, we can recognize that we probably have unions here, or at least structures within structures, as this looks very much as if there's an array of structures inside this other one. Oh, whoops. Okay, quickly have to, okay, fix it. So this is a fairly accurate representation of the structure. We still have to add the recursion to the plugin. This final plugin will not be public anytime soon because the code is so bad and I usually only publish with half a year delay. So ask me again in 6 months. Anyways,
hello?
What? Okay. I think I'm pretty much done with my speech because, I'm done. I don't have anything else to say. And I have to apologize. I have to apologize for having bored the security folks in here with the object reconstruction stuff. It's probably only interesting to those hardcore reverse engineers. But still, was a pleasure to be here. And does anybody have any questions concerning what I said? Yes? Actually, the question was whether I had the nerve to mess with standard library templates.
Standard template libraries.
What are those?
It's another imagination in the object-oriented world that adds to give another level of complexity.
Ouch. No, but I think I will at some point. What I have done recently is look at DCOM code, because I have the feeling that I will be looking at that a lot in the future. But no, I haven't messed a lot with object-oriented stuff. I have to admit that I bought myself a book on C++ last fall, and I've never actively programmed in C++, so I don't really know much about it.
That could be. Assembly, they're just standard language.
Okay, well, good. Okay, no problem. Yes?
When do you patch a program, do you need to update the PE header checksum?
Sir?
When you patch a
Whether I have to update the PE header checksum when I patch a program. Usually I don't, because PE header checksum is only checked by default in device drivers. So, in normal applications, you don't need to do this. Any other questions? No? Well, then, thanks for listening to my stuff, and have a nice day.